5 Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a group of restaurants in Eau Claire will raise the minimum wage to $16 per hour and do away with expected tipping. We'll learn more about the move and the precedent it could set. First, Senate Republicans blocked voting rights legislation backed by Democrats yesterday. The bill would have overhauled elections in the U.S., including national guidelines on early voting. It's a week in Washington. We'll talk about how the move is putting on pressure on Democrats to end the filibuster and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What voting and or election reforms would you want to see, if any? Do you support publicly financed campaigns or an end to voter ID restrictions? Or do you think it should be up to states to decide whether to take up those kinds of changes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mark Fisher is a senior editor at The Washington Post. He's also the author of the book Trump Revealed, the definitive biography of the 45th president. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Rob.
Let's set the stage here on this filibuster of the voting rights legislation. First of all, a few different plans have bounced around. Which one was on the table in the Senate yesterday?
Well, this was a big sprawling package that the Democrats have wanted to put forward to expand voting rights across the country, kind of a rebuff to all of the piecemeal restrictions on voting that Republicans have been pushing in a number of red states. And so this was the big shot that the Democrats had. And not only were they unable to get Republican support for it, but they don't even have unanimous Democratic support for all of the measures in that package. They did manage to hold their group together, but it wasn't enough. And so what we have here is a federal effort by the Democrats versus a state effort by the Republicans, and an inability by either party really to prevail on a national basis.
I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Here he is after Republicans voted to block debate on this voting rights bill yesterday.
Every single Senate Republican just voted against starting debate on legislation to protect Americans' voting rights. Once again, the Senate Republican minority has launched a partisan blockade of a pressing issue here in the United States Senate. An issue no less fundamental than the right to vote.
We've heard from Schumer and other leading Democrats that this isn't the end of the story. That said, at least for this package of legislation, is there any option to move forward with it now?
Well, it's probably the end for that exact package, but there are a number of possibilities. One is remolding that package in some ways that might make it more palatable, might win the full Democratic support, and maybe break off a few Republican votes as well. Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat in the Senate, is really the key to Democratic unity, and he has this, he's been pushing for the Democrats to be more flexible on photo ID for voters, and it looks like a lot of Democrats are coming along with that, and that may be a surprise to some people on the left of the party who thought that that was a hard line that they agreed to take, but now even Stacey Abrams, the voting rights advocate, and former President Barack Obama have embraced Manchin's proposal that Democrats go along with Republicans and say, yes, you really need to show a photo ID in order to vote. That's a view that 80% of Americans agree with, according to recent polling.
And we're going to talk about that more on the show tomorrow. But you use the phrase pry a few Republicans away. Is there any thought that this proposal, by compromising on things like photo ID, can pry 10 Republican senators onto Democrat side here?
No, that seems a bridge too far. And so that brings us right back to that filibuster discussion that you were talking about earlier. So the question is, if you can't get the 60 votes that you need in the Senate to pass most measures, then is there perhaps a rule change that would allow a governing party that only has a small majority to get some things done? And so Democrats are talking about, well, maybe we should change the Senate rules so that it's 55 rather than 60 votes that are needed to pass bills, but you would need a majority, and you'd need to break away some Republicans to get that rule changed as well. Maybe, I mean, you could do it with just Democrats. The problem here is that there's nothing that looks like it's going to create a bipartisan kind of agreement on voting rights or even on some of these other measures that the Democrats are pushing.
Talking to Mark Fisher from The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress pass something when it comes to voting and election laws in this country that will apply uniformly in all states? If so, what? Guarantees of early voting, disclosure of big political donors to certain kinds of groups, they were on the table. Gerrymandering legislation, would you be okay if it included voter ID laws, mandating some form of voter ID in states? Join in with your thoughts. Oh, and is it worth ending or changing the filibuster to pass something? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark, we've heard some of the Democratic arguments here. What have we heard from Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and the other 49 Republicans who voted with him to block debate here? Why were they opposed to this package of legislation?
Well, they think that this package is essentially an effort to solidify or expand the Democratic majority, to get Democrats elected in more places, to boost the ability of Democratic voters to get to the polls. And so they see this as a partisan effort. And so they're dead set against it. And they're going to try to obstruct it in the way that they've done so efficiently in recent years on these kinds of measures. So this is really a complete partisan kind of stalemate that we have. And the question will be whether Democrats change the rules to break the stalemate. And there are a lot of centrist Democrats who are still worrying that any changes made to Senate rules might come back to haunt them when Republicans are in power, and they would take advantage of that ability to move things through in a much easier way.
The Democrats, as you said, all 50 of them would pretty much have to agree to make changes to the filibuster. Talk about some of the holdouts. I mean, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, for example, probably others. Have they given any sign that they would say, yeah, we can tweak that filibuster?
Not really. I mean, Joe Manchin did come up with his own proposal for a voting rights bill that made some gestures toward perhaps winning over some Republicans, or at least making their objections seem purely partisan. But that's not to deal with the filibuster. He remains, like Sinema, he believes that the filibuster is something that is a good thing because it forces both parties to move toward the center and toward compromise. That's how it works when things aren't quite as divided as they are now, when we have parties that are saying, well, you know, we'll vote against things, as Mitch McConnell often says, just to stop the other party from getting a victory. So that kind of political advantage trumps any policy agreement that they might have between the parties.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was going to say that one of the things that I believe is very important in this bill is dealing with gerrymandering, which is something we've been having a problem with here in Wisconsin for several years. And Republicans complained about having independent commissions as supposedly taking democracy away. But when state legislatures use gerrymandering to basically rig their own elections, that's not democracy. So the independents actually protect it. And we know this and have for several years. If you go to a Wisconsin State Journal article from August 1st of 2012, it's titled "Documents Cast New Light on Redistricting Process Reveal Partisan Motivations." And that's basically where we saw that they knew exactly what they were doing when they drew the maps. And it wasn't voters who were going to be picking who was going to be in charge of the state legislature. It was the legislators themselves.
Nate, thanks for the call. And gerrymandering and redistricting, obviously a hot issue over the next year, Mark, as those lines are getting ready to be redrawn with the new census data. How big a part of this bill was that?
It's not a huge part. There were some efforts to nudge states toward using a more independent kind of process. There are a number of states around the country that have that have appointed independent boards that do the districting, or at least create the proposal for how the districts will look. And that the idea is to take the partisanship out of the process and perhaps make for districts that make a little bit more sense and that don't look as crazy quilt on a map as a lot of the ones we have today do. But I think that's really a state issue by and large. And the bottom line, interestingly enough, is that although gerrymandering does make for some very strange districts and does solidify incumbents, it doesn't really make a huge difference in the outcome of elections. And there have been some interesting studies that have shown that you could have these independent anti-gerrymandering boards in every state, and you wouldn't end up with a terribly different looking Congress.
Thanks for that call, Nate. We'll go now to Randy in Preston. Randy, hi.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I get very frustrated when I hear all the talk. There are so many simple things that could be done to make voting simple. Easy. I mean, first off, in that bill is making voting day a federal holiday, like most of the world does, except for like Uganda or Myanmar. And so that'd be a first one. And the problem with that for Republicans is that means a whole lot of people who work crappy jobs and aren't allowed to leave and stand in line for 6 hours, don't vote because it costs them too much. So that'd be a big one. This whole thing is all about the more people who vote, the Republicans realize they're not going to win elections. And that's what it's all about. And
Randy,
everybody knows it.
Thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Nate, our guest Mark, back in on this. Mark, was that voting holiday part of the one that was up in the Senate, or was that part of one of the other things out there?
Yeah, that was part of the package that the Republicans blocked yesterday, as was an expansion of early voting, automatic registration of voters. So these are, as the caller says, ways in which the Democrats want to expand the voting pool, and Republicans in some states believe that that would hurt them. But it's not an entirely black and white issue. Really, there are quite a number of places around the country where Republican voters, especially older voters, have taken full advantage of early voting, of mail-in voting, and so it behooves Republicans to support that to get their voters out as well. And so we've seen that more than half the states just this year have already lowered barriers to voting, creating more of those kinds of early and mail options, making it easier to register.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post. He's with us for our weekly look at the top news in national politics. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, President Biden is talking about new initiatives aimed at turning around a rise in violent crime and gun homicides. Want to hear what, if anything, you want to see from the federal government on those issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Mark Fisher stays with us from The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on a new federal effort aimed at turning around rising violent crime numbers in the country. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, what are we hearing from the Biden administration about gun violence around the country?
Well, the president came out today and wanted to address this soaring homicide rate that we're seeing in a number of cities across the country, quite a few cities. And he wanted to get on top of an issue that Republicans have been making some political hay with as they present the notion that the Democrats are soft on crime, soft on violence. And this is an interesting turn of events because Joe Biden has never been one to back away from being tough on crime. He actually kind of made his political political career, as did Kamala Harris, by being tough on crime. He is a senator, she is a prosecutor. They both sort of backed away rhetorically from that toughness during the last campaign and in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd and the demonstrations around the sort of racial reckoning about police brutality. So the Democrats found themselves, because of the left flank of the party's embrace of the idea of defunding the police, found themselves very much on the defensive. And now President Biden is trying to turn that around and say, look, we're going to be tough on crime. We're going to use some of this COVID relief money to pay for additional police officers. We're going to be tougher on gun dealers who sell guns to people who shouldn't be getting them. So there are only a few things a president can do to combat crime. It really is a state and local issue, but Biden is going to try to at least send the message that Democrats are not trying to defund the police, but want to actually bring down those homicide numbers.
And Biden, according to tapes that have been released, was not happy with the defund the police message from his party, and a Democratic Party analysis said having that message out there hurt Democrats probably in the last election. Could you talk about Biden versus that defund the police message?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that we saw during the campaign. Biden did not want to embrace that term or that idea. He pushed back against it. And he did so in such a way that at least for the purpose of the campaign, the left side of the party was quiet about that. And you didn't hear quite as many people talking about defunding the police. Now, and the Democrats have managed to maintain reasonable unanimity on that, at least as far as their messaging goes at the national level. But the fact is that that phrase really put a chill down the spines of a lot of people around the country, and Republicans have made taken great advantage of it to paint the Democrats as being weak on crime. So Biden is trying to say, hey, look, this is who I've been through my entire career. I'm not someone who is going to embrace defunding the police. In fact, I'm going to support the police, and he wants to do so with a large sum of money to hire more sheriffs, more deputies, and more police officers. And so that will endanger him with some on his left who believe that, that those are the wrong moves to make at this time, given the country's discussions about race.
That's no surprise that crime gets politicized. I guess it always does. This is an increase in violent crime that started in 2020, the last year of the Trump administration, continuing to go up in 2021, first year of the Biden administration. Is there any, I don't know, any sentiment in federal government that is like, hey, maybe let's not make this a partisan issue and let's look and try to work together to find things that work?
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous amount of effort going into figuring out exactly what we have before us, because although homicides are way up, a 25% increase across the country in the past year, other crime is actually down, and overall crime is down about 6% in the country. So it's not an easy issue to understand. Yes, there's been a very large increase in gun sales over the last year, and certainly from the Democratic side, you'll hear people blaming that for the increase in homicides, but Republicans will respond by saying that this is a matter of an inability or unwillingness to address violent crime in big cities on the part of their Democratic mayors. So it does get political very quickly, but I think there is a real effort underway to understand why these homicide numbers that had dropped so consistently and dramatically over the last 20, 30 years are suddenly back up again. Again, nowhere near the levels of the 1990s, but up disturbingly.
Talking to Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, about some of the top stories in national politics. I want to wrap up, Mark, looking at the Biden administration's vaccine goals. The Biden administration says the U.S. is going to miss the president's goal of getting 70% of Americans their first shot, at least, by the 4th of July. What happened?
Well, what happened was that the folks, especially older people, very much took to the vaccine in most of the country. Younger people, not so much. And then there are two big problems that the Biden administration faces in getting to that 70% vaccinated number. Number one, and you know, both on the left and the right, you hear constantly about these two groups as separate stories. On the one hand, Donald Trump supporters, anti-vaccine people, people who reject the science and the news about the efficacy of these vaccines. And on the other hand, Black and Hispanic people who have historical or cultural doubts about vaccination. Those are really, although we hear about them separately all the time, they're really the same story. They're really about the collapse of trust. And that's what this administration is up against. This enormous number of people around the country who do not trust in institutions, in medicine, in science, in the politicians who are delivering the news about the vaccine. And so there is this continuing hesitancy in important parts of the country. And so the Biden administration is struggling to how to appeal to people who are still hesitant, whether it be through, as some governors have done, through lotteries and giveaways and that sort of thing, or through PR campaigns. The good news is that there's been an extraordinary pace of vaccinations in some more affluent and highly educated areas. And the bad news is that there have been very low numbers in some other places, particularly in the South and in parts of the middle of the country. So, you know, the Biden folks will be able to say, yes, we are well on our way toward that 70% goal. They'll probably end up the July 4th weekend at 68% rather than 70. And they'll be over the 70% mark in about 20 states, but that still leaves quite a few where they haven't gotten there.
So in our last minute or so, the initial concern was on the supply side and the logistics side. Sounds like we've got that figured out. Now it's keeping the demand up. Is that the challenge we're facing?
And it's really about reaching young people who obviously tend to congregate more and maybe are a little bit less careful in many places. And so these new variants that are very dangerous and very transmissible, they spread more easily. So that's one of the big goals now is to get to the teenagers and especially the younger teenagers who are just now becoming eligible for the vaccine. Here in Washington, D.C., in the affluent part of town, 67% of teenagers have already been vaccinated. In the poorest part of town, only 5%. That gap is visible in a number of places around the country, and it's a really serious gap.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That's Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, author of the book Trump Revealed, the definitive biography of the 45th president. He joined us today for our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. We'll follow up on a couple of those issues tomorrow in our conversations. We'll look at some of the latest surveys that Mark actually referenced on what people think of different kinds of voting laws, including early voting, voting access, and voter ID. We'll also take a look at that increase in homicide rates, gun homicide in particular in the United States, and possible solutions. Coming up today, after the news, we'll learn about a restaurant group's decision here in Wisconsin to raise its minimum wage to $16 per hour and dial down on tipping. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Milwaukee's health commissioner shares the latest on big issues facing the city, including an update on vaccination efforts. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, an Eau Claire-based restaurant group announced it will raise the minimum wage of its employees, who work at least 20 hours a week, to $16 an hour. The Pablo Group says they will also provide benefits for these employees, and they will also dial down the expectation of tips. Tipped employees have a substantially lower minimum wage. The decision comes after President Biden increased minimum wage for federal workers to $15 an hour, and businesses are struggling to find enough employees for lower wage work after the pandemic. We're talking about the minimum wage, particularly for employers who work for tips. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a tipped employee yourself? Do you like working for tips or do you think the minimum wage for tipped employees should be increased? Should tipping be done away with altogether? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Laura Dresser is Associate Director of COWS, a research center at UW-Madison, and a Clinical Assistant Professor of Social Work. She's an affiliate at the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to give a listen to Rita Dorsey, Director of Experiences at Pablo Group, the restaurant group, which owns the restaurants going up to $16 an hour. Here's a listen.
So you know that you're at least walking out the door with a certain amount of money that hopefully will help you budget for your bills and let you know what you can afford and can't afford to do. And hopefully it allows you to afford to do a lot more than you could previously.
Laura, I know you look a lot and think a lot about minimum wages. Can you tell us about minimum wages for tipped workers in Wisconsin, how they work, how different they are?
Yeah. So this is a place that I'm, you know, your listeners will have to tolerate a little into the weeds dive, because technically tipped employees are, they have the right to the minimum wage at $7.25 an hour, but tips count past $2.33 an hour, which their employer pays them. Tips count to the $7.25. So, and mostly nobody says you didn't pay me enough, but it's technically the case that if a tipped employee is not making $7.25 off of the tips, then they could demand that money from the employer. But it just doesn't work that way. Basically, you get your $2.33, you get your tips on whatever system the employer has, and that makes service work for tips especially unpredictable and especially volatile. And so I really appreciated that point that we had in the listen. Like, this is about predictability. These workers can know they're going to get a certain number of hours, at least 20 hours. And one of the real issues in service work in restaurants is getting the hours, getting enough hours. And then you see the other thing going on, which is really establishing a floor for the work so people have the predictability. So that's kind of exciting to see in this proposal, this agreement that they've pursued in Eau Claire.
Do we know whether tipped employees, like how often they don't end up even hitting that minimum threshold, even though technically employers are supposed to make it up if their tips don't bring them up to that minimum wage?
I think there's been, I don't know of any research during the pandemic of that issue. And obviously there are some serious questions about demand and tips inside the pandemic. Folks who stayed on in restaurants, who were dealing mostly with takeout, people have a kind of different orientation to tipping on takeout. And so I would expect that the picture was much more volatile in the context of the pandemic than before. I think what we do know about the way tips work is that the inequality that we see in almost all labor markets is really emphasized in the tip, in the kind of the set of restaurants where people work for tips. So it's true that there's a high end of restaurants where the servers, the costs of the restaurant are pretty high, the attention to service is very high, and the tips that workers are earning are pretty high. But there's a lot of restaurants with a different model and much lower tip takes on those, and much more volatility in how many people are coming in. And so I think at the lower end of that kind of distribution of the cost of the meal, you also have a lot more volatility in traffic and tip volume for the workers in the lower cost restaurants.
Laura, another concern I've heard about, and I talked to somebody with the National Group of Restaurant Workers focusing on this issue a while back, that tipped workers might be more vulnerable to harassment, including sexual harassment by patrons. If this customer is causing a problem, but I'm dependent on their tip to, you know, make a living, am I really able to raise that as a concern? How big a problem do you see that being?
I mean, you know, I don't have statistics on that, and but we know anecdotally, especially women, especially people of color, who can face hostility, harassment, you know, inappropriate behavior from their customers. And the tip, you know, the need to secure the tip to get your money is one thing that makes that that the structure of that even more, you know, kind of onerous on, you know, in terms of tolerating unacceptable behavior from customers. And so that I think that's really true. I think another way to see the inequality that sometimes happens in restaurants along especially race and ethnic lines is it is often the case that the back of the house is the location where so back of the house work, like sort of prep work and also dishwashing or clearing tables, busing, that kind of work tends to have greater racial and ethnic diversity in it. And those workers that are workers that are often outside the tip. Depends on how the restaurant runs the tip split. But one thing you see going on there at Eau Claire is that everybody is getting that raise, everybody in the restaurant, not just, we think first of the servers working for the tip, but also how you move that money from the tip into other occupations that are creating that experience is really opaque. Different restaurants do it different ways, and it tends to be unequalizing. And so when you move the floors and when you move the transparency, you are actually closing that gap as well.
Talking to Laura Dresser, Associate Director of COWS, a research center at UW-Madison, looking at minimum wage, especially for tipped employees. A restaurant chain in Eau Claire saying, hey, we're moving away from tipping, bumping up the minimum wage for everybody across the spectrum in those restaurants. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234 on the minimum wage for tipped employees and the minimum wage more generally. Do you think it is time for a change? Call 800-642-1234. I want to hear from a couple callers now with perspectives on the restaurant and tipping debate. Let's start with Paul in North Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey there.
What do you think, Paul?
First of all, I want to tell you thank you for your show. Mr. Ferret, you are amazing.
Thank you.
I've never seen. I've listened and a huge fan.
Thank you. I'll hold up my tip jar for you now.
I'm a musician, and I may have called in that context previously, and we put tip jars out as well. They don't usually get filled. My comment is I lived in Europe for 17 years. I was living in Denmark, and they do not have a tip system in their country at all. And subjectively, I can tell you, the service level is no lower. When an employee is responsible to their employer and paid by their employer, the service is actually equally good. And I totally agree with your host or your guest that, we create this pseudo control for our customers. And really, most of us are kind of like, what should I tip? And it's a worry we really don't need.
Paul, thanks for that call. I want to get another perspective from Marcus in Milwaukee. And thanks for the kind words, Paul. Marcus in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. So I used to be a waiter when I was in my late teens, early 20s, younger, when I was in college. I was at a number of restaurants in Brookfield, Wisconsin. And from my experience, I feel like, and this is just personally speaking, but if you take and eliminate the tip, it kind of eliminates the impetus for those employees that want to go above and beyond, really provide a super high quality, high level of experience. Because in a certain way, as a waiter or a bartender or waitress, we're selling ourselves. And I mean, not necessarily like physically, but we're selling our personality. Okay. We're selling the experience. And so, I just feel like if you take and eliminate that, you're going to eliminate some of that extra high quality, because what's the incentive for me to work harder and go above and beyond if I'm going to make the same as the next person who's just kind of dragging along?
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. So, Laura, there you have it. Two different takes on the motivation structure behind tipping in those service industries, especially the restaurant, bartender kind of jobs. What do you think?
Well, I think there's – so I appreciate the kind of range of perspectives there. I sort of land on the my sense is that, this is personal. As a consumer, I actually, I appreciate good service, but a lot of different things are good service. Someone who knows not to talk too much sometimes is exactly what I want. What feels like good service can be different for different people in different, or for the same person at different times. But also, I'm going to drop the same amount. I don't use it as an incentive. I think at least a lot of people I know, they have a way they tip, and they just tip people that way. So I don't know that, I do know that there are workers who do better than other people on tips and work hard at that. But I also know that a lot of restaurant workers are distracted by the very low income, the volatile hours, you know, the kind of stress of low wage work. And so you can have, like the first caller was saying, context like in Denmark, where service is good because workers have a job and they have pride in that job, but they don't have a kind of, they're not trying to hustle each person. They just have a capacity to attend to the job. And so I think either, I think the truth is you can get a lot of good service out of either system, but you get a lot more inequality out of the tip-facing system, the tip-driven system, especially inequality inside, sometimes on the traditional axes of inequality, race, gender, right? That kind of ability to harass or not inability to avoid the harassment or avoid racist behavior or correct that in a service relationship. You know, we feed some of those things. And then we also feed these disparities where in higher price point restaurants, people do better. But in lower price points ones, it's just a hustle and people sometimes aren't even making the $7.25.
Thanks to Paul and Marcus for the calls. We're talking to Laura Dresser right now about the recent decision by an Eau Claire-based restaurant group to raise the minimum wage in its establishments to $16 per hour and dial down on the tipping expectation. Laura's a labor economist and associate director of COWS, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. We're going to look at some wider issues of the minimum wage coming up. Do you think it's time to raise the minimum wage? Do you think we should get rid of the separate system for tipped employees? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the minimum wage for tipped employees and for everyone with COWS Associate Director and Labor Economist Laura Dresser. Laura, before I go back to our callers, I just want to get your thoughts on the latest on the minimum wage, an issue we've talked about many times before, calls to raise it, some protests about it. And now here we are in this post-pandemic landscape where we're seeing a lot of people raise their wage to try to lure employees. What are you looking at now?
Well, I think it is an interesting moment to be thinking about the minimum wage. The federal government, there's the Raise the Wage Act that would take this national minimum wage, which has not been raised in more than 10 years, more than a decade, to $15 an hour by 2025. Right now, Wisconsin is at $7.25 an hour. We're one of 21 states who are still at the federal minimum. When the federal government doesn't attend to increasing the minimum wage for 10 years, you know, states begin to take it into their own hands. Illinois is at $11 an hour. Minnesota is over 10. They're all moving their wages every year. Our neighbors have the minimum wages going up. And Wisconsin is just being left behind. And I think one of the things that I've been thinking about in this moment, when you see some upward wage pressure a little bit in the restaurant, the leisure and hospitality industry, really kind of isolated in there, as you think about, like, if I'm a worker near the Minnesota border and I can work in restaurants on the if I'm going to have my job search on the Wisconsin or Minnesota side of that border, I'm going to look for a job in a restaurant on the Minnesota side. I know there's no tip minimum, that it's higher. There's a higher minimum wage. I'm not going to be at 233. I can count on that. That transparency makes restaurant work in Minnesota more attractive. And I know we always talk about, I think there's always been a lot of concern, oh, if our minimum wage is higher, won't all the employers move? But it's a restaurant game. And it's thinking about where restaurant workers going to go right now. That is also an interesting question in this moment of consideration of minimum wages and how far behind our neighbors Wisconsin is getting.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rob is with us in Appleton. Rob, hello.
Hi.
Go ahead, Rob. What do you think?
I think that the federal minimum, or the minimum wage, should be $15 an hour in the whole country. And I believe that the tips, and that includes tipped employees, and I believe that tipped employees should be able to collect up to $100 in tips per 8-hour shift, and then before they would have to declare those tips. I think we'd have motivated servers, knowing that they're making 15 to begin with, and then they also get tipped, and their tips would depend on, customers are still going to want a tip. That's just the way it is, and if they get good service, they're still going to tip. So that's a motivation for people to work in the industry, and in the tipping industry, I think it's just to raise the level of pay for all Americans.
Rob, thanks for the call. Laura, Rob, making the case for $15 straight up, and maybe tips if you still get them.
Yeah, right. And I think it's interesting to that structure would raise the wages of 1 in 3 workers in this state. So I think a lot of times people think about the time they worked at the minimum wage. I know I do. I think about the 80s. I worked in the minimum wage. cleaning test tubes. And then, you sort of think, well, that wasn't a lifetime at that wage. But I think when you realize that 1 in 3 workers could be impacted by raising the wage to 15, you realize how much of this labor market, where people are doing important work that we identified as essential across the course of the pandemic, right? The work that allows life in the society, grocery store work, food chain work, whether that's, growing or harvesting or processing or serving, nursing home work, childcare work, all these workers that are the hands of the economy, the essential workers whose wages have lingered near the bottom, just seeing, if we're going to call this work essential, let's reward it a little better and let's move the floor on this labor market.
Thanks for the call, Rob. Time for one more caller. Sally is with us in Madison. Sally, hi. Oop, looks like we lost Sally there. Well, just in our last minute or so then, Laura, what are you watching for? Are you watching for any action? We've talked about state level. At the federal level, we had the president raise the minimum wage for federal workers. Anything else, do you think, in the works?
There's certainly federal legislation. It's also the case, I like to remind people, on the November ballot in Florida, Donald Trump won that state, but at the same time, that same electorate moved, passed a referendum to move the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And I tell you that to say that this is popular. If people could choose, Republicans and Democrats alike support raising the minimum wage. So it's sad that it, seems stuck in Congress, but I'm hopeful that, that we'll see 15 coming out of DC. I'm hopeful, but not, I guess, kind of, that's more optimism of faith than a practical assessment at this moment.
Laura, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of COWS, a research group at UW-Madison, and a Clinical Assistant Professor of Social Work. She's also an affiliate at the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. You can read more about the story that prompted this conversation and this restaurant group in Eau Claire. That's over at WPR.org. And a lot of people have weighed in on this and on that news story over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can let us know what you think about the idea of a higher a guaranteed minimum wage for tipped workers, whether that's led by, say, a restaurant chain itself or a change in state law. And let us know what you think of the minimum wage in general. Again, you can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a job-related conversation again. Take this job and leave it. Quitting is up in the American economy as people seek new lines of work. We'll find out why that's happening now, what it means for the future, and you can tell us if you have quit a job lately or you've had somebody quit a job after they were working for you. You can start us off right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. also tomorrow, we'll find out what Americans support when it comes to election laws, according to recent surveys. And you could share some of your thoughts. It can all inform discussions on what's going on in national politics right now. And a new project aims to boost home ownership opportunities in Wisconsin during a time of high prices. Find out about the Take Root campaign. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Earlier this week, we invited you to call in with your favorite ice cream flavors. I was off that day, which is too bad because I missed your calls. But I still get to play because a lot of you joined in afterward to share your favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here we go. Margaret says dark chocolate cherry chunk. I've never had that. And orange chocolate chip. I don't think I've ever had that either. But Margaret goes on, but really, they're all my favorite. Karen says, death by chocolate. Can't go wrong with lots of chocolate. Cheryl, though, says, I must be the exception. I don't really like ice cream, except in chocolate malts and root beer floats. Julie says, spumoni, which I looked up. That's I've heard of it. It's like just a bunch of stuff thrown together. I don't know. James says, chocolate, a classic. Ravana says, peppermint. Tyler says, this bleep just got serious from Kennedy's in New Glarus. That's a chocolate shop ice cream flavor. One of my favorites. It's available just a few blocks from my house, which has been dangerous over the last couple of years. Bev goes with Blue Moon. June says turtle cheesecake. Scott says black cherry. Joel goes with rum raisin ice cream. Amanda says Cedar Crest cookie dough. Christine says Häagen-Dazs coffee. Well, if you share the Wisconsin tradition of trying to read the flavor of the day on your local ice cream store or custard shop, you could share your favorite flavor again over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.